I'm glad to see everyone who is joining us this morning. Surprise, I'm not Greg. All right. Greg was supposed to be preaching this morning, but with everything going on, I'm going to be filling in for him this morning. You know, there is a powerful, powerful thought that's contained in that passage that Tim just read for us. And the thought is this, that God is the master of our lives. He is the one that molds us, shapes us, and he uses us for his purposes. Right? He has a plan for us and our lives and how we can be used to bring about his honor and his glory, that his name can be proclaimed throughout all the earth. That's what that passage is trying to get us to understand. And I don't know about you, but I have often struggled with this idea. When I was a young man, when I first became serious about following Christ, one of my struggles was I was always wondering, am I on the right path? Is this what you want for me, God? Is this what you want for my life? And how do I know that? Right? That, I mean, honestly, that was a question I asked a lot. Then I went to preaching school. And as we, you know, you got 2 years in preaching school, and then you're supposed to go out and proclaim the kingdom and advance the kingdom. And I was like, well, what in the world is that going to mean for me? Am I supposed to be a pulpit preacher? Am I supposed to be a campus minister? Am I supposed to be a missionary? Like, there's all kinds of paths that are out there and open, God. Like, which one is, well, how are you going to use me? And I wrestled with this. I really did. Even now, as an adult, as I've grown, and there have been times in my life, you know, where I've gone, is ministry, full-time ministry, is that really the right path for me, God? You know, should I be a medical doctor, God? Or maybe should I be a professional basketball player? Okay, maybe not that last one, right? Yeah, shaking your head. I appreciate that, the honesty. Okay. Yeah, we can rule that one out pretty easy, right? I don't need to be a professional basketball player. That's not good for me. It would be very embarrassing, right? But here's the idea. We struggle with this idea. We doubt, we question, God, what is the purpose in this? Why am I having to go through this? Why is this the path that you've chosen? I mean, we ask those questions. We really do. I think if we're honest with ourselves, all of us at one point in time or other have wrestled with this idea. And I want us to think about it. When we have those times of doubt, at least for me, I know that Scripture gives me comfort. Because I can go to Scripture and I can see that I don't have to have all the answers. Because in the end, it's not up to me, that it's up to God, and that God has a plan. He's made me for a purpose. And God will work out his plan for me if I will follow after and seek after him. I may not know what it is. I may not have the understanding. But I do know that much at least. And so my question is, what about you? Have you ever wondered what God was doing at a certain point in time in your life? Have you ever been in that certain situation where you looked at the circumstances that are going on and you thought, I don't understand, God. Why is this? I just don't get it. Have you ever been there? Have you ever been in that really hard spot in your life where honestly you're hurting? Where you feel like almost everybody else is against you? Where you are pretty much alone and you cry out to God, where are you? And you're trying to decide which path and what the purpose is and which way he's trying to lead you. Have you ever been through that time where we live in this constant state of wonder and doubt? Maybe something happens and you don't understand why this had to happen to you, and it places this overwhelming doubt, this overwhelming sadness, sorrow, hurt, whatever, however you want to look at it, and it begins to overwhelm the other blessings and joys that God has put in our lives. Have you ever been there? Right? When we're in those situations, do we move forward, placing our faith and our trust in God? Or do we allow those things to hold us back? What about this? What if we never know why God allowed us to go through a certain way? Why we were shaped and molded in that particular situation? How do we handle that? What about when we do? Have you ever been in one of those hard situations in your life and you're going, why, God? And you never get an answer until years later. And then you run into somebody who's going through a very, very similar situation, and you're able to reach them and touch their life in a way nobody else has. And then you go, oh, hey, look, I understand now. You see, these are the things that I think about. Y'all don't want to be around me early in the morning because I think about a lot of these kinds of things. But here's the idea. I believe that God has a plan for us. I believe that God has a plan for me. He has a plan for you. And I believe He has a plan for everybody that will come to Him. And He's committed to working that plan out into a reality if we will follow Him. So I want to give you just a couple things before we get started. First, here's my disclaimer. The idea that God has a plan for us and He will work it out into to a reality does not mean that we live without ambition or we wander aimlessly around waiting on God to come blaze some miraculous path for us. Okay, that's not what I'm talking about. And what I am talking about, secondly, is this. We need to strive to live according to God's will. And as we seek God, we can have the assurance that He's working on our behalf. He's up there behind the scenes, moving things around, working things to the end of bringing about where we can be used to bring honor and glory to Him. And we can trust that because we see it over and over and over again throughout the pages of Scripture. And so to help us see this, to help us recognize this and guide our thoughts this morning, I want us to look at how God worked in the life of man. I've heard that you guys studied about this morning, the life of Joseph. Okay, we're going to look at the life of Joseph and see this. And I want us to look at the idea of seeing God in our lives. How do we do this? How do we see God in our lives? You know, a lot of times when we think about Joseph, we tend to think of him as the hero. We tend to think of him as this guy that was very, very godly, very, very mature for almost all his life. But I'm going to suggest to you this morning that even though he ran away, he was sold into slavery, he lived among these pagan cultures, he was faithful, even though he ran away from sexual temptation, that maybe Joseph isn't quite as high up on the pedestal as sometimes we like to put him. Let's begin by looking at his life. If you have your Bibles, open them up to Genesis chapter 37. We're going to start there. In Genesis chapter 37, I want us to begin reading verses 2 through 4. It says, "These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all of his other sons, but because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a robe of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peacefully to him." All right. So when we're talking about Joseph, I want to just point out a couple things that I found it very interesting when you study the idea of the story of Joseph without our preconceived blinders on. Okay, the first thing that Joseph does in this story, the thing from which we get our first impression of his character, is that he brings a bad report to his father about his brothers. Now, if you're like me, you've oftentimes assumed that this is Joseph is a godly person, so he must be telling the truth, and his brothers are awful bad people. But here's the problem with that. That word bad report is not a neutral term. When you study that word out, it's actually a negative term against the person who's speaking it. You find this same term used about the spies that bring back a bad report in the land of Canaan. That's the same word. You also find it in Proverbs, where it says, "Only a fool utters a bad report." Right? This term says Joseph probably was not the kind of virtuous man that we sometimes imagine him to be. That he gave a bad report, not reflecting necessarily bad on his brothers, but that would have been reflecting bad on him. Right? And you can look at Numbers 14:36 and 13:32. You can look at Proverbs 10:18. You can see it again in Psalm 31:13, Jeremiah 20, verse 10. This word is used throughout the Old Testament, and it's always in a negative sense. It's not necessarily a common word. It's kind of a rare word. But what I want you to understand is when we meet Joseph, if we understand how this word is used, our first initial impression of his character should not be one that he's this great, virtuous person with these bad, evil, awful family. Nope. Joseph has his own problems to work through. His character is not all of that that we sometimes think. We kind of let him off scot-free. You know, he's this wonderful person. And he kind of gets away without having to answer for the consequences of his actions. In fact, even in the story, he doesn't, because he's rewarded for his bad behavior with a coat from his dad showing that he's the favorite amongst the brothers. Why? Oh, maybe because Joseph lied. Maybe because Joseph said some things that weren't true. Now, let me show you something else that I think is very interesting about Joseph in this story. If you go back and you look at Genesis chapter 12 through 50, right, what you're going to find is that there are no heroes at the beginning of all of their lives. When we're talking about Abraham, you're talking about Isaac, you're talking about Jacob, or even, I'm going to suggest to you, Joseph falls in the same pattern. They don't start out as heroes of paragons of godly virtue, right? I mean, think about Abraham. When we meet him, he's called to go out to this land. He's going out, he's going to follow God. But on the way, what does he do to his wife? He puts her in a bad position by saying, "Why don't you lie and tell people you're not really my wife, you're just my sister." It's just the small lie. That puts her in a really bad spot. Not once, but twice. That's how he treats his wife. I mean, he's not necessarily this paragon of virtue sometimes that we see. Isaac does the same thing, and he shows favoritism to his sons. Remember that whole thing? The brothers, they're fighting, they're competing. That's where we get the whole Jacob and Esau kind of thing. Because Isaac was not necessarily this paragon of virtue, right? His wife, Rebecca, probably not a whole lot better. Okay, look at what she does. She says, "Let's deceive my husband." Right? Jacob. When you talk about Jacob, Jacob engages in the same kind of bartering of favoritism. That's what we're seeing right here. Who's my favorite son? Oh, it's Joseph. All the rest of you, you guys are great, but, he's better. Right? Look at how Jacob interacted to get his wives. You see, we sometimes whitewash the scriptures and we don't see them for how they are. When we think about this, these men start out with some flaws that God has to kind of polish off so that they can become who he needs them to be that kind of a person to lead his people faithfully. He does it with Abraham, he does it with Isaac, he does it with Jacob, and I'm going to suggest to you this morning, he even does it with Joseph, and that's what we're going to see. We're going to look at Joseph and see that Joseph doesn't really necessarily start out as a hero either, but he becomes one towards the end. Let's keep going in Genesis chapter 37. In Genesis chapter 37, beginning in verse 5. Now Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, "Hear this dream that I have dreamed. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaf rose and stood upright. And behold, your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf." And his brothers said to him, "Are you indeed to reign over us? Are you indeed to rule over us?" So they hated him even more for his words. All right, I want you to pause right here and just kind of think about this a little bit. How old is Joseph at this time? He's 17, the text tells us. He's 17. Now, Joseph is the youngest at this point in time, right? He is not at the top of the food chain when it comes to inheritance, when it comes to leadership, when it comes to authority. Honestly and truly, when you look at it in a realistic term, Joseph was the ruler over the dog. And that was about it. Right? So when you think about it in terms like this, Joseph was the last in his family in the position of inheritance, of authority, any of those kinds of things. And yet, he's telling his brothers, "I'm going to rule over you." I mean, that's some heady stuff coming from a 17. I mean, all right, dads, older brothers and sisters, let's think about it. If your younger brother or sister comes up and says, "I'm the boss of you, I'm going to be the boss," you what? How does that go? I can tell you, as an oldest child, I'd be like, "Prove it. Let's go." Right? That's how I would have reacted. No, you don't get to be the boss of me. Right? That's not the way that works. Right? But this doesn't stop there. Let's keep going in the text. In Genesis chapter 37, looks at verses 9 through 11. It says, "Then he dreamed another dream and told it to his brothers and said, 'Behold, I have dreamed another dream. Behold, the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars were bowing down to me.' But when he told it to his father and to his brothers, his father rebuked him and said to him, 'What is this dream you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come to bow ourselves to the ground before you?' And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind." All right, so let me kind of illustrate something else that I found that very interesting in this text. When it says there in verse 9 that Joseph told them about his dreams, It's my understanding that that word told is not just a one-time thing. It's a repetitive kind of thing. So this is not like Joseph had this dream. Yay, I'm excited. Let me tell you about this dream I had. Like, you know, when your kids get up on Sunday morning sometimes and do that to you, right? No, this is one of those things where it's kind of a bragging thing. He told him about this over and reminded him and reminded him, kind of poking and gouting. And I mean, you know how that goes. I mean, if you have children, you know what they do to each other sometimes. But then Joseph takes it to the next level, right? And it's not just he's telling this to his brothers anymore. He's telling this to his father. Now, we sometimes go, that wouldn't go. I mean, think about it, dads. If your 17-year-old son came up and said he was going to be the boss of you, I'd be like, yeah, when you have a job, Bubba, you might be able to tell somebody what to do in your own house, not mine, right? That's the way we react now. But in that time, this was unheard of. You don't, as a 17-year-old youngest in the family, you don't go to your father and say, you're going to bow down to me. I mean, wow. There's a whole idea of honor and respect that goes with this culture that Joseph just shredded. And when he talks to his father Jacob that way, I mean, there's no honor, there's no respect that he's showing his father. And we know that because his father rebukes him. And we're talking about Jacob. We're talking about somebody who's had interactions with God. I think that's why he keeps this in mind. But he knows, hey, this is not okay. It's not okay for you to talk to me this way, son. This is not the right way. Right? And I believe that Joseph was indeed going to lead. I believe that that's something that was going to happen. I believe that God was showing him the future. But I also think what we're seeing here is that he became engrossed in this idea of ruling over his brothers, right? Of being the leader. I'm going to be in charge. I'm going to be the boss. And instead of accepting it as the responsibility that it's going to be, he reacts immaturely. And he sees that, oh, this is to my credit. This is to my glory. And he forgets that he's not going to get himself there and that it's not about his glory, that it's about God's glory. And I think that's what God is fixing to show him as we progress through his life. That Joseph, you by yourself are nothing. That it's all about me and it's about what I'm going to do through you. It's not about what you do. You see, as long as Joseph relates to this position of leadership like we see right here, he's not worthy of it. And so God's going to have to transform Joseph into the man that can handle those responsibilities and still be faithful. Right? All right, so what about us? I think sometimes we struggle. We're like Joseph. We struggle with our immaturity. We struggle with the idea of God and why we're going through certain situations. And I think we struggle with seeing God work in our lives because sometimes we're spiritually immature and we have pride about us. And we misunderstand what God is trying to do. You know, in our arrogance and in our immaturity, we take the blessings that God has given us and when we take it and we turn it around, we say, oh, look what I have done. Oh, look what I have accomplished. Look what gifts and abilities I have. And the focus is not on God, but it's on ourselves. And we can't be that way. Because when we do that, we won't see God working in our lives, or if we do, we may not enjoy it like Joseph is fixing to find out. Right? When we find ourselves wanting others to acknowledge what we have done, who we are, how important we are, may I suggest to you that we need to grow and shift our focus from ourselves to our God. I know that I have kind of done this in my own life, seen this in my own life. You know, when we were in preaching school, my last year of preaching school, I worked with a little congregation called Miller Street. And I worked with them the whole year. And they were a small little congregation, not big people, not big in size, number of people, but great people. I think there's like 30 people there, maybe. Small congregation. Worked with them the entire last year. But as we got through towards the end of preaching school, I had my heart set on being a campus minister. I had been impacted in my life during college years. That's where I became a Christian. That's when I grew. I thought, I am going to do that for other people. I'm going to be to them what somebody was for me. I'm going to make that kind of an impact. And I had my mind made up. And at the end of school, the congregation, the people there came and said, please stay. Please work with us. We've loved it. We're growing. Please stay here. But I had my mind made up. I wanted to do that. Lacey wanted to be close to her family when they were in Oklahoma, and this is in Denver Metro in Colorado. And so I said, nope, sorry. We're out of here. And I realized it because I remember lots of my classmates were surprised. They're like, what are you doing, Jonathan? Why are you passing up this opportunity? Don't you see what God is doing? And I honestly couldn't. I was so caught up in myself and what I wanted that I wasn't open to really seeing what God was doing. And I think sometimes we do that in our lives. We get so caught up in what we want and what we desire that we fail to see what God is actually doing because of our pride and our immaturity. Joseph went through the school of hard knocks, right? He had lots of lessons to learn. And he did. He learned them the hard way. And one of the things about him that I admire most is that all throughout all of this, he did not give up on God. How long do you think Joseph went through these trials? I don't know if you guys talked about this morning or not. But he was 17-ish when he was sold into slavery, Genesis 37. Genesis 39, verses 6 and 7 says, after some time, he was placed over Potiphar's household. I don't know exactly how long that would be, but I'm imagining it's not going to be a week or two. Okay, Joseph would have had to prove himself as a manager, as trustworthy, as respectful. All those kinds of things. Then there's the whole thing that happens with Potiphar's wife. He gets thrown into prison. And then in Genesis chapter 39, verses 19 through 23, we're never told exactly how long Joseph was in prison. But again, it's enough time that Joseph earns the trust of the jailer, the man in charge of the jail. And he's put over all of those who are in the jail. Okay, Genesis chapter 40 and verse 1. That's where he's put in charge. Genesis chapter 40, verse 4. There's these men who are put into Joseph's custody, and there's some time that passes before they even have their dreams. And we know these as the baker and the cupbearer, right? Then he interprets the dreams, and after that, they get released and they come true. And it's 2 years after that, after they're released, that they even remember that Joseph could interpret the dreams when Pharaoh has his other dream that nobody else can interpret. And then by the time you get to Genesis chapter 41, verse 46, when Joseph is released, he's now 30. 17 when he went in and 30 when he got out. 13 years. I want you to think about that. 13 years of slavery, of being in prison, of going through all of these trials and these hardships. And I'm sure that Joseph learned a lot of lessons. I mean, it's very obvious. Joseph learned how to manage large groups of people. I think that's part of the idea. He learned principles of leadership, I'm sure. What is involved in caring for others, all those kinds of things. But one of the things that I want us to really focus on is I think there's a spiritual lesson that Joseph learned that would be good for us to learn as well. Because I think it really applies to us. Sometimes, the lesson is this. Sometimes, in order to see God working in our lives, we have to wait in faith. We have to wait in faith. If we want to see God working. There's two parts of this lesson I want us to briefly touch on. We could go a lot, but we're just going to touch on a couple of them. First of all, is humility. Right? Whoops. Humility. What is humility? When you think of that term, what comes to your mind? What is humility? Some people think that a humble person is someone with a bad posture. Or maybe somebody that's too timid to speak up. But that's not really what humility is. We need to change our understanding about this. Humility, on a practical level, let me just speak to that. Humility is when we realize that the job itself is more important than the accolades that come with it. We're not worried about whether people praise us, how much they admire us, look good on us, or any of that kind of stuff. We're worried about following God. You know, when you see Joseph later, when his brothers come back and they have those interactions with him, he didn't care about getting the praise or the credit. As a matter of fact, he tells his brothers, you intended this for harm, but God intended it for good. He gets the praise, the honor. His focus is on God. It's no longer on himself. And so I think on a practical level, being humble, having humility means that it's accepting the fact that I won't get the credit and that's okay. And I think that's one of the lessons that Joseph learned, because we see him change. The other one is being yielded. Living a life of humility before God means we need to be yielded to God, right? How does that look? I think it looks like this. When we live a life of trust of God, in God, in the midst of trouble, that's being yielded. I imagine that when Joseph was first sold into slavery, he probably struggled with being yielded to God. Why is this happening? Why don't those, man, he was probably so angry with his brothers. How could they do it? I'm their own flesh and blood. Right? I'm pretty sure Joseph had some resistance. How can this be God's will for me? I don't understand. And yet, throughout this process, we find that Joseph came to terms with this, and he yielded himself to God. He submitted himself, and he learned. I mean, here's the simple truth. God can do anything, but by his own choice, God will not force his plan for our lives on us. He wants us to choose to yield our lives to him so he can use us. And I think that's something we need to think about. Are we being yielded? You know, I sometimes look at my life and go, am I being yielded? And I don't know that I can always say yes to that, to be honest with you. Sometimes I think I'm stubborn. Sometimes I think God says, okay, let's go to the polishing block here and take a few edges off there, Jonathan. I need to learn to be yielded. And I'm willing to bet, probably if you looked at your life, you can probably see some of the same things. Sometimes where God said, no, I need you to be yielded, and you're being stubborn. Let me take a few things off. We need to learn to be yielded to God. That's how we find his will for our lives. As you go through the rest of the story of Joseph, right? The visions come true. He interprets Pharaoh's dreams. They had the 7 good years. They had the 7 bad years. He's placed in charge. He collects all the grain. He's over everybody in the kingdom. Okay, just kind of summarizing here. If you don't know that story, go through and read Genesis, like the whole almost last part of it from 37 on, and you'll find it. Okay? But here's the idea. When Joseph's brothers come to Egypt for grain because there's a famine in the land, they meet Joseph again, right? And in Genesis chapter 45, that's where we're at right now. Genesis chapter 45 as we go through Joseph's life. I want us to read verses 4 through 8. Okay? Genesis chapter 45, beginning of verse 4. Joseph said to his brothers, come near to me, please. And they came near, and he said, I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine had been in the land these 2 years, and yet there are 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he made me a father to Pharaoh and a lord to all his house and a ruler over all the land of Egypt. You know, when you look at this, after 13 years of being enslaved, being imprisoned, Joseph finally sees God's plan coming into place. And after 20 plus years, because he was over that for a while, the 7 good years had already come, now they're into 7 bad years. Now he's beginning to see the fruit of his faith. Right? I want you to think about that. 20 plus years for him to see the fruit of his faith. And you know what's interesting is you read down through here, Joseph cries many times in this process of reconciling with his family. And I'm sure a lot of us read this and we go, oh, he loved his family so much. It must have been so good for him to heal and for them to mend those fences and all those kinds of things. And while I'm sure that was part of it, I'm sure that Joseph on some level had resigned himself to never seeing his family again. I also wonder if somehow it was not just a reconciliation between him and his family, but an understanding and a reconciliation between him and God. He began to understand and see what the purpose in all the things that he had gone through. I mean, that's what he says. He says, you didn't do this. God did this. He sent me here to preserve my family. God, you see, Joseph's focus has totally changed when we see him here. He understands. He's right with God. He understands what God was doing, how God was working. And I think that's something that we need to look at and think about sometimes when God is working, we have to wait in faith in order to see it. We may not understand it now. We may not understand it in two or three years, 5 years, 10 years. It might take 20 plus years for us to see the fruit of our faith. But we shouldn't let that make us say that God is not working in our lives. Right? All right. Let's go through, summarize the rest of the story of Joseph. There's one more thing I want us to point out about his life. If we go through, his family's united. They come there. They all move. He provides for them. But if you jump over to Genesis chapter 50, towards the end of the book here, Genesis chapter 50, I want us to focus in on verses 24 through 26. This is at the end of Joseph's life, okay? He's near death when he's saying these things. And then in Genesis chapter 50, verses 24 through 26, it says, yet the bow remained unmoved. His arms were made agile by the hands of the mighty one of Jacob. From there, the shepherd, the stone of Israel, by the God of your father who will help you, by the Almighty who will bless you with the blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that crouches beneath, blessings of the breast and of the womb. The blessings of your father are mighty beyond the blessings of my parents, up to the bounties of the everlasting hills. May they be on the head of Joseph and on the brow of him who is set apart from his brothers. And as he goes through, look down in verses 28. It says, and these are the 12 tribes of Israel. This is what their father said to them as he blessed them, blessing each with the blessing suitable to him. And he commanded them and said to them, I am to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Hephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field at Machpelah, to the east of Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite to possess as a burying place. Notice what Joseph sees here. He says, look, God is surely going to visit you. I want him to carry my bones. I think I read the wrong passage, you guys. I think I read out of 49. Let me try again. I was like, why did that not match? All right, let me try this again. For 24. It says, and Joseph said to his brothers, I am about to die, but God will visit you and bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear it, saying, God will surely visit you and shall carry up my bones from here. So Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. There we go. That's better. All right. So what I want you to notice from this is that Jacob knows his part in God's plan is ending. He said, I'm about to die. I'm on my way out. But notice the faith that he still has. Right? Hebrews chapter 11 says the same thing. By faith, Joseph, at the end of his life, made mention of the exodus of the Israelites and gave directions concerning his bones. Joseph still trusted in God, even though he was never going to get to see what he was hoping for, that his people got to go back to their homeland. He knew he wasn't going to get to see it, and he still trusted in God. And I believe that it was Joseph seeing how God had worked in his life over the years that helped him develop this kind of faith that he had at the end of his life. And that's our challenge, guys. We need to develop that kind of faith. A faith that trusts in God and believes that God knows what he's doing even when we don't see the goal. Even when we don't understand. Right? And here's the idea. Here's something that's always amazing to me. Joseph's faith left a lasting impression. And we know that because in Exodus chapter 13 and verse 19, when the Israelites leave Egypt, they take the bones of Joseph with them. How did that happen some 400 and something years later? Because of the faith that Joseph had and the faith that he lived. And I'll be honest with you, as I think about this, this is my goal. I want to develop and strengthen that kind of faith. A faith that doesn't affect me and how I live, but lives on in other people, that passes it down and leaves an impression so that their lives are changed and the lives of the people after them are changed. I want God to be able to use me in a way that brings honor and glory to him, not just now, but in the times to come. So my question is, what about you? Where are you at in your life? Do you see God working? And if not, why not? Is it perhaps when we don't see God working that it is our own pride and immaturity that keeps us from seeing that? Or is it that we are in that period of waiting And God is just wanting us to keep remaining faithful to Him. Is that what's going on? Or when we can't see God working, is it the fact that we haven't truly yielded our lives over to Him, that we're holding things back for ourselves? And if you see God working in your life, are you enjoying the fruits of your faith? Or maybe are we dissatisfied with what God has done? If we're dissatisfied with what God has done in our life, why? Could it be that our focus is more on what we want than on what He wants? Could that be why we're dissatisfied? Are you to the point of your faith where you still put your trust in God first, even if you don't know the ending of what's going on? See, I think that's a challenge for us. We like to know how it's going to end before we begin. But that's walking by sight and not by faith. We need to learn to walk by faith. And you go, Jonathan, I don't know if I can do that. I want to remind you, Joseph didn't start out as a hero. He became one. God transformed him through that process. Right? Joseph wasn't a hero because of his innate goodness. But because through God working in his life, he was transformed into who God needed him to be. I want to encourage you, if you're here this morning, let God transform you into who He needs you to be. Become that person who walks by faith, not by sight. If we can help you do that, please come as we stand and as we sing.